the loneliest tree on the planet. Let's think about that. It's a particular tree. It's a Sitka spruce. It's not just lonely. It may also, well, represent something quite profound about our times. Chris Turney will explain. He's Professor of Earth Science and Climate Change at the University of New South Wales. Chris, good day.
Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
Tell me about this tree.
Oh, this is the loneliest tree in the world. It's extraordinary. It's a pine tree, Sitka spruce, so a Christmas tree, as most people would know. And its traditional place where it's happy is the North Pacific. But back in the early 20th century, it was planted on this remote island in the sub-Antarctic called Campbell Island. And it's been growing there quite happily for nearly a century.
Quite happily?
Well, I know. Well, the weather is shocking, actually. It's something like 300 plus days of rain. Honestly, it's worse than where I came from in Britain. But anyway, it's growing about a centimetre a year, so it seems to be doing quite well.
Well, it's cracking on. So here is this tree, and I'm imagining surrounding it is not other trees. Surrounding it would be that sort of sub-Antarctic low tussocks of grass kind of effect.
Well, yes, but there's also an occupational hazard in working in that part of the world, unfortunately. It's summertime, basically. It's the only time you can get down there by ship. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, you have a lot of sea lions, males. It's mating season, and they tend to congregate around there. And they're not the most friendly of guys. You know, see everything as a competitor. So you end up fighting off tens of kilos worth of blubber while you're trying to collect samples. It doesn't go into the health and safety risk form.
Now, this tree is more than just the sum of its parts.
Yes, very much so. There's been a debate, actually, ever since really geology became a known or recognisable discipline back in the 18th century, that human beings had caused an impact on the planet, especially the Europeans and later North Americans in particular, and Russia for that matter. And so they recognised early on that actually we were leaving evidence of that in what would later become the geological record, debris from industrial waste and the like. But one of the problems we've got with human activity is it's not only the scale of it, and it's increasingly so, it's very patchy with regards to time and place. And alongside that, over the last 300 years or so, we've been working towards getting a geological timescale. People would be familiar with the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary, the end of the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. It's just one example. Mm-hmm. We have our very own one here in Australia, the Ediacaran, pretty much a dawn of life in the Flinders Mountains going back, or Flinders Hills, I should say, going back 540 million years. But there's been an ongoing debate for nearly three centuries or so about what impact humans have had on the planet and whether we've left an impression on the geological record. So basically, if we all disappeared now and some sort of lizard archaeologist turned up in the future, they'd see we've had an impact. Effectively, have we become a geological superpower? And there's been numerous debates, and it's a bit like if you're a writer, everyone's got an opinion on this. Everyone's got a story. Everyone's got an opinion on when this began. And it's been loosely called the Anthropocene, the human epoch. And the question is, well, when and where is it? And using geological criteria, we're basically looking for something that's been left in a geologic forming material. So that could be rocks, sediments, trees,
a tree, yes.
Anything like that might be fossilized or preserved in the record. And but using geological criteria, we have to show it happened around the world at the same time, so which is why trash and clearing of forests in one area doesn't mean it's a globally the same time.
Okay.
And one of the ideas has been, Jonathan, basically nuclear weapons tests, particularly centered on 1960s, which was the peak, the thermonuclear tests, left an incredibly, ghastly impression on the natural world. Effectively, there was an explosion, literally, in radioactive nuclides that was distributed around the planet. And one of the ones, which people might be familiar with if they've watched NCIS and or watched Time Team and the like, is something called carbon dating or radiocarbon dating.
Right.
And in the Northern Hemisphere, all these plethora of explosions, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, led to more than a doubling of radioactive carbon in the atmosphere. And that was distributed globally and basically gets taken up as CO2 through photosynthesis and then is locked up in living matter. Ourselves as well, we're all radioactive. Fortunately, we're not glowing at night, but the Christmas tree preserves us.
Soon, Chris, soon.
Oh, I hope not.
So I'm guessing, I'm guessing that we're going to be able to draw a link here between that moment in the 60s of the creation of all that radioactive debris and what we might find, let's say, in the trunk of a rather lonely tree somewhere in the subantarctic.
That's right, yes, you've exactly. So we were really curious about this as an idea, as a debate, but a lot of the research has been done. This has been inherently done in the Northern Hemisphere. And, of course, if you want to show a global signal, it's got to be in the south because it's as far away as you can get from where most of the tests were done. And so we've been taken two voyages down to the Southern Ocean where this and subantarctic island is. There's a wonderful expression, an old sailor's expression, below 40 degrees south there is no law, below 50 degrees south there is no God. It's an extraordinary journey.
Far down are we now?
Well, we're going down to 53 degrees okay. south. You can keep going, which we did. But
Godless and remote.
Godless and remote. And it's a beautiful island. It's a precious piece of real estate in the Southern Ocean. And it's carefully looked after by the New Zealand Department of Conservation. And, of course, this is an alien tree. It shouldn't be there. But it doesn't appear to be a threat to the local ecosystem because, unlike most Christmas trees, people will be familiar with Christmas cones. This thing's been living there nearly a century, but it has never given off a cone. The weather is so awful, it's so wet, and it's likely to remain
so. Puts its energy to get a little bit bigger, never mind reproducing.
Exactly. So basically, it's forever young.
All right, so you drilled into it because you're a curious sort of fellow.
That's right. So we had the team and we were curious about doing this. And you can drill into a tree. It doesn't harm the tree. And we can take out a straw of wood that has the layers of wood, the rings of growth. And you can count back for the rings. And then you can measure the radioactive carbon in those rings. And because you know precisely the date, because of the rings of growth, you can then compare that to records for the Northern Hemisphere.
And you're going to tell me that you found radioactive carbon inside that poor little tree.
Oh, gosh, yes. Spoiler alert, yes, we did. We did. And so the peak was there. It wasn't as high as the Northern Hemisphere, but it happened pretty much the same time. And so it effectively, the peak occurred in the latter part of 1965. So I guess the question is, Jonathan, were you born in the Holocene, which is the last interglacial, the current one, or are you born in the Anthropocene? For the listeners, I'll let you guess where I am, but a lot of my friends and colleagues have been curious about just where they fall on the geological timescale now.
Oh, so here's this tree, which is just a record of all that we've seen, and well, I guess is it maybe somehow symbolic that there it is still standing?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's there. It's there because of human activity, and we found the same signal preserved in peat bogs and lake sediments. So it's a global signal. But the beauty of the tree is because you can date it so precisely, it really allows you to hone in precisely when that bomb peak happened in the Southern Hemisphere.
The bomb peak of the 60s, that's time right. of great nuclear testing. Are there other things that we have done subsequently that give us similar recorded global peaks of particular materials?
Well, this very much falls on the backdrop of a lot of things that have been happening in the latter part of the 20th century. There's a lot of research talking about what they call the Great Acceleration. So alongside this huge increase, exponential increase in human population, urban populations, GDP, mobile phones. Alongside that, we've had a whole range of different environmental changes, rising CO2, global temperatures, ocean as well as atmosphere. Ocean acidity, of course, is another thing. And they're going hand in hand. And they really started, it was this mass expansion in the global economy after the Second World War. And so it doesn't, the bomb peak, this peak in radioactive isotopes doesn't define the very start of it, but because those are very disparate as well around the world, this is a very handy way of actually describing or capturing the great acceleration.
How does the Anthropocene end? I mean, is there potential for it to be, as it's humanly created, to be humanly resolved in a possible way? A positive way.
I mean, that's a very interesting debate. I mean, this is just our proposal, of course, for the beginning of the Anthropocene. There has been an argument, and it's being considered as one potential contender. There has been an argument for a while that because of this great acceleration and we're continuing to grow and our economies are still growing, that actually perhaps it's too early. We don't know where this story ends. So one of the arguments could be, well, you know, and hopefully this is the case. I mean, joking aside, this is an incredibly important issue, but we've effectively disrupted the whole Earth system. At the moment, we still have a potential of actually pulling back and actually living in a more sustainable way, much like as we were just hearing from your previous
speaker.
Although
we too are of the Earth.
We are very much of the Earth. And as a result, but the implication is that we're leaving ourselves an impression on that geological record as well, long after we may be here.
What a wonderful tree that spruce is.
It's quite remarkable, actually. And if you you can visit a core of a wood we have in UNSW, and we've also donated one to Invercargill Museum and Art Gallery. And so you can go and visit it. But if you are very fortunate enough to go to the Campbell Island, or I think you might be putting a photo of a tree up on the website.
We will definitely do that on the blueprint
listeners
page,
will see that. But it's not your classic-looking Christmas tree, you know, a lovely sort of cone shape. It's quite a stunted thing.
It's burdened by care.
Yeah, it's probably excessive pruning by researchers wanting to celebrate Christmas in previous years, but that's just an allegation.
it's a fascinating thing, Chris. Thank you so much for bringing that into our world.
Absolute pleasure. Lovely talking to you.
Chris Turney, he's Professor of Earth Science and Climate Change at the University of New South Wales. And that tree, that loneliest tree in the world, down there in the godless realms below 50 degrees south. We will put a picture of aforementioned pine on the blueprint page on the RN website.